Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Sometimes we want the world to be a better place than it currently is. Until that time, people gather in South Dakota and across the globe to talk about understanding history and creating a better future. The South Dakota World Affairs Council presents a symposium on global mass violence and atrocities. It runs Thursday and Friday of this week at South Dakota State University's Waldstroff Ballroom. Dr. Evgeny Finkel is Assistant Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. He is the event's keynote speaker. His new book is called Ordinary Jews, Choice and Survival During the Holocaust. He joins us now on the phone from Washington, D.C. Dr. Finkel, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you.
What brought you into this line of work?
Trying to understand what makes people not make their choices or how people behave under those conditions. And a lot of it's my personal history. I'm Jewish. I was born in Eastern Europe. Some of my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. I grew up in Israel, where there was also a lot of political violence. So it was a natural choice for me to try to understand how people behave under those conditions and how we can make the world a bit safer.
When you talk about how people behave under those conditions, are you talking about how people, survive, the people who are being persecuted? Or are you thinking, is your main area of study the people who are perpetuating the violence?
Well, all of them.
All of that.
Actually, I'm interested in all of them. The book is about the victims, but what we do know from many years of research on people in those conditions that, you know, most people who are in those conditions, even the perpetrators, they're not crazy people, they're not criminals, they're normal people. So what makes those people tick in those conditions and what makes them to make the choices that they do? That's what I'm trying to understand in my work.
Hmm. Do you think you'll ever do you come to a place where you understand it a little bit more?
I think so. Yeah, I think we can make some progress in understanding. My biggest fear is probably that I will never be able to fully understand, but at least, you know, to scratch the surface a bit. That I think we can do, and that I think we are doing over the last two or three decades in this line of work.
Mm. Can we talk a little bit about your book for a moment and really looking at different survival strategies and how people who were persecuted by the Nazis, Jews who were persecuted by the Nazis in different areas of the world responded differently? Give me an overview of this book and who you looked at.
So my biggest goal was to focus on three cities in Poland and Soviet Union that were very similar in many respects. You know, the size of the Jewish community, the percentage of Jews in the community, they had overlapping political histories. Yet what I found that in different cities, even though they were pretty close by, the distribution of choices between people differed quite a lot. So, for example, in one city, about 50,000 Jews escaped, and more than half of them survived. And in Holocaust terms, where the average survival rate in those areas were about 1%, 15,000, it's a lot.
Right.
In some of them, the Jews rebel. In some, the Jews did not. So even though we're talking about people who are similar in many respects, come from the same ethnicity, same religion, speak the same language, share a lot of other similarities, there was something that made them behave differently, you know, from one place to the other next door, and that's what I try to understand. And what I found out is that actually a lot of what drove this difference was not about the Nazis, not what about the Germans did, but about how Jews and their neighbors interacted before the war, and how states treated the Jews in those different cities. And it wasn't about high politics. It's about very basic stuff like forcing or encouraging segregated or desegregated schools, or promoting ethnically integrated labor market. And while that happened, Jews had non-Jews who could, they turned to for help, ask for help. They could also pass as non-Jews and hide. So even this pretty basic stuff like going to a school with with members of another group, another religion, another ethnicity would often be a difference between life and death under those conditions. So on the ground, it's not about high politics.
Right.
It's about actual people and how they interact with their neighbors.
So was there a sense that, in the places where they were maybe more integrated, they could mix with non-Jews more easily, was there also a sense that they were more likely to be helped by non-Jews? What about the bystanders? Were they behaving differently based on the way the community was set up before, before Nazi atrocities
Definitely.
Began? Or
Definitely.
Okay. All right.
Because both the Jews knew who to turn to for help, and the people to whom they turned for help, it was hard for them to say no to people they knew for many years.
Right.
So it also affected the bystanders, and it prevented people who in other places could have become perpetrators. Instead, they became helpers.
Right. What sort of set things up before that would cause a group to rebel, to take up a particularly effective resistance movement or armed rebellion?
So some of it has to do with geography.
Okay.
And that's pretty natural. Where you have mountains or forests, it's easier to hide, it's easier to escape. But a lot of it has to do with experience. And what I found in my book is that in places where there were Jewish organizations that trained before the war for resistance, it was much easier for them to do it when the Nazis came. Or where people were persecuted by the state and went underground because of their political beliefs. Again, even before the Nazis came, when the Nazis came and when the Holocaust started, they already knew how to do it.
Mm. This doesn't necessarily mean that more people lived, though, right? I mean, so many died. Even when we talk about choice, we have to be careful to make sure we're not saying, this is how people survived necessarily, right?
Yes, of course.
There
was a lot of randomness in the process, but even a small difference between 0 chance and 1 or 2% chance of survival, it's a lot when you look at the odds of making it through the process. And we know that some choices did have an effect on survival rates. Again, trying to escape or rebelling, quite a lot of those people did survive, people who did nothing or people who just stayed put and complied quietly or even tried to work with the Nazis. Almost none of those survived. So it did affect survival rates, even though they were low.
You said your grandparents are Holocaust survivors. What kind of stories did you hear growing up about their experience?
Well, I didn't hear that many stories, frankly. They tried to keep it to themselves. Most of the stuff that I heard came from looking at archival materials or testimonies that they left for various oral history projects. That's how I started this project. So for them, there was not much they preferred to tell. I knew that they were Holocaust survivors, of course, but in terms of what they experienced, the real shock came when, I became an adult, I became a scholar, and actually went to the archives and started listening to their testimonies. They were much more forthcoming with strangers than the members of their family.
So you were able to hear your grandparents' story that they told to strangers?
Definitely. Strangers, wow. I mean researchers who collected those testimonies. Yes.
That's fascinating. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Evgeny Finkel. He is an assistant professor of political science at George Washington University. The book is called Ordinary Jews, Choice and Survival During the Holocaust. He's coming to the South Dakota World Affairs Council for a symposium on global mass violence this Thursday and Friday at SDSU. And I'm wondering next about, certainly after the Holocaust, mass violence and global atrocities and genocide continues to happen in human history. What connections do you make in your research from what happened at the Holocaust to what we see happening in Rwanda or in Bosnia or in other places in the world?
So, again, my focus is on ordinary people during those situations. And I think that a lot of what we see or what I found during the Holocaust is applicable beyond Germany or beyond Eastern Europe. We can help people to help themselves under those conditions. it probably will never be possible to prevent mass violence or to prevent genocides from taking place. That's a very tall order, and I don't think we as an international community will ever be able to do it. What we can do, though, is, again, to create conditions under which it will be easier for people to survive, like promoting integration of minorities, or investing in educational initiatives, or even knowing where people will be more likely to rebel or escape and help them. That doesn't mean, you know, sending the planes in and bombing perpetrators. It doesn't mean having boots on the ground. That doesn't require military intervention. What it does require, though, is a long-term commitment that we can do to stop, if not stop, then at least help people who are targeted by mass violence to survive and to make the choices that will help them survive. And it goes beyond the Holocaust. I think that stuff that I identify, like integrated, ethnically integrated educational systems, so ethnically integrated labor markets, they go beyond the Holocaust. The same is true for Rwanda. The same might be true for Bosnia. Those who are targeted by violence, they need their neighbors. They need others to help them. So the goal is to create those people.
When does that begin? How is there a sense that that has to begin decades before the problem occurs, or can it, can it begin in a shorter period of time once violence starts?
It will be very hard to do when the violence starts. The violence starts, we can know who will be more likely to survive. So realistically, we can try to help those people, but it doesn't have to be many decades. What I found in my work, that when the government or when the state is serious about integrating minorities or creating peace between different groups, it doesn't take that long. It takes years, yes, so it's not immediate, but it doesn't take decades.
What does integration look like when people also want to preserve a language or a heritage?
Well, it means being bilingual or trilingual. It means knowing the culture of the other group. It does not necessarily mean giving up on your own language or your own identity, but at least knowing the people who live next to you, their traditions, their religions, their culture.
Hmm.
Again, you don't need to give up on your own. Just know those of your neighbors.
Why ordinary people? What fascinates you to spend, so much research just really talking about, again, not necessarily that macro view or the big political situation or the fighter jets, and the military action, but really breaking it down to helping people help themselves in these kind of situations. Why is that so captivating for you?
Because I think that was very long missing from our discussion. You know, we tend naturally focus on leaders or the guys on the very top of the hierarchy, or those who can give orders. But more often than not, we fail to change their behavior. And more often than not, we fail to prevent them from committing mass atrocities. And what frustrated me is, again, the lack of focus on people like my grandparents.
Right.
For instance, so I did try to understand them. Of course, it was a very conscious attempt to understand what they did, how they survived, and also in the back of my mind, even though it's absolutely non-historical, we're living in a different era, but how I would have behaved under those conditions.
Right. Yeah. We all wonder that, don't we? In some ways. And wondering what kind of stories you were able to uncover that surprised you or that helped provide a breakthrough for you. What kind of individual stories helped put these pieces together in your work?
So there were a lot of stories. I worked with hundreds, probably more than 500 testimonies, written, oral, video testimonies, diaries. And many of them were mind-blowing in different respects. So, for instance, I discovered that the best survival strategy for Jews during the Holocaust was to pretend that they're non-Jews and go to Germany, because in Germany no one would recognize them as Jews. That was absolutely mind-blowing.
Wow. So people actually headed straight into the lion's den.
Yes, exactly, because that was the safest place.
And they survived.
And they survived.
Wow, that is kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about healing afterwards, or survival beyond the moment when you're threatened by physical violence. Have you been able to continue and see how people survive long-term, and what their, you know, their health or their happiness or their, you know, standard of living, or, you know, however you, you know, quality of life, however you would measure that, to say who took scars with them that they really never overcame, and who was able to live what ended up looking like a life that they wanted in spite of or after what they had been through?
So everyone took scars.
Right.
And everyone was affected by that. But survival or the experience also did make people more resilient. Hmm. It affected them. It affected most of them deeply. And the fact that my grandparents didn't tell me anything for years, it's not unique. That's a typical reaction of Holocaust survivors that I saw across the board. People kept quiet for decades. Only when their grandchildren were growing up, they started to open up a bit, and even that would be more to researchers or those who collected those testimonies rather than to members of their family. So people did live with that for decades, but it did make many of them more resilient and more committed.
Hmm. As many of these Holocaust survivors are aging and passing on, what's lost, you know, to researchers? Because this seems like, you know, an angle, you've taken an angle in your research that I have not seen anyone else take before. I'm not well-versed in this area, but it's interesting to me. So there are other areas that have not been explored. What are we losing as you know, the Holocaust survivors and World War II veterans die?
I think we start losing our moral compass a bit when those people are not around to remind us what happened, why it happened, and what we should do to make it never happen again. Without them around, it becomes easier to forget or to pretend it never happened.
When you come to the South Dakota World Affairs Council in Brookings this week, what's your area of presentation? What can audience members expect you to talk about?
So in my presentation, I want to focus exactly on those issues that I talked about, how to help people make the right choices, both as bystanders, as potential perpetrators, and as those targeted by violence, and how we in this country can make this happen. Hmm. How can we hold our elected representatives accountable, and how can we push for those issues?
I think it might be challenging for some people to think about, okay, this country, because they don't necessarily see that's something that could happen here. But you say there's things that we need to consider.
Well, I think every country has a potential for violence, and this country had also experienced a series of quite horrific violence against different populations. No society is immune from violence happening in the past or in the future. Actually, almost all societies in the world experienced mass violence. So can it happen here? Probably not now. Hmm. Hopefully not in the foreseeable future. But it does happen around the world, and it does affect us whether we want it or not. So even if it's not going to happen here, it's going to happen near us.
How do we look back at our own history, though, when we look at how Native Americans were treated, you know, in South Dakota, for example, right here on the land where we stand? Is there a way to have a conversation about the atrocities that occurred that will somehow help us move forward?
I think we should have this conversation. I think it needs to happen, and I think it is happening in many quarters. Whether we should do more, definitely.
Hmm. Dr. Finkel, any final thoughts that you wanted to share with us today, questions I didn't ask you that I should have asked?
Hey, I just hope that as many people as can would come to this symposium tomorrow and on Friday, and will start seriously thinking about what's going on in the world, not only in this country, when it comes to mass violence.
Yeah. So much more to say, but we'll let you get back to your day. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Evgeny Finkel. He's coming for the South Dakota World Affairs Council presentation of a symposium on global mass violence and atrocities. That's Thursday and Friday at SDSU. Go to the Wahlstrom Ballroom. We'll put a link up on our website at listen.sdpb.org so you can find all the details. His book, by the way, Ordinary Jews, Choice and Survival During the Holocaust.